In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, Mike and I discuss planning your move from day job to product. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 254. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. So where this week, Mike?
Well, I've only been back from MicroConf for a couple of days now, so I haven't gotten a whole lot of work in. But aside from that, I bought a new car, and it's been the most painful experience I've had all year.
Right?
The past like 2 or 3 years. Like they, for whatever reason, like they don't make it easy to like get a price quote. And I kind of get the reason, but it's just painful to get price quotes from anybody without having to actually like walk in the door. It just sucks.
Even in this day and age of the internet, car buying still not solved.
I know. And I like I said, I understand why they do it, because they don't want you to go around to like 10 different dealers and get a price quote from them and then shop it around to them. But still, it's just like you'd think it'd be easier.
You know, you've done a lot of enterprise software sales. Now you know what it feels like to be on the other end of that. Am I right?
Yeah. I appreciate that.
Totally. Well, me as well. I've been back to work essentially 2 days. I did some work over the weekend to try to catch up on email. Had a big backlog. But I've spent the last 2 days kind of cranking through and getting caught up and really figuring out the focus of the next couple of months, because it's kind of time to continue building what we started during the summer. With Drip, we've been doing webinars, we ran a contest, we have the content engine is going, we have a ton of integrations going, there's just a lot going on. And while I was away in Europe, I was able to keep pretty close tabs on that. What's nice is with Slack and email and GitHub with CodeTree on top of that, it was just easy for me to keep an eye on and figure out what was going on and to kind of keep up to tabs with it. And so the nice part about being in Europe for that month was that I was able to do a lot of thinking, and I had enough space because I was separate from the office that I wasn't kind of caught up in the day-to-day as much. And so I made a bunch of notes about some entirely new projects that I want to take on, some new angles of both marketing and on the sales side. We actually need some inside sales help, and I'm going to be looking for someone part-time to help with that. So there's a lot of interesting stuff that's on the docket, and I'll probably talk about it once more of it's implemented, but kind of planning right now about the next 60 to 90 days of what I see the marketing and sales winding up, and then also working with Derek on figuring out what the next 60 to 90 days of the product is going to look like.
So do you have an idea of how you're going to go about planning that stuff? I mean, is it going to be based largely on, I guess, interpretation of what customers are asking for? Or you know, like, do you have very specific things in mind that you know need to be done, and it's just more a matter of prioritizing at this point?
It's the latter. Yeah, we have a couple hundred feature requests, additions, tweaks, some of which have come from us internally of how we want to make the tool better for our own use. I mean, I use Drip for, well, we use it for MicroConf. I use it for my book. We use it for the podcast. I use it for Drip and Hittail. I use it for Zen Founder and Startups for the Rest of Us podcast. So I have a myriad of use cases on my own that we use it internally, right? So everybody in there is kind of putting feature requests in. And then we have customers constantly asking for stuff. So the list is long. The challenge is prioritizing and figuring out what is the next thing that is going to either retain the most customers or get us the most new customers. And that's really the evaluation process we're going through.
Cool. So what are we talking about this week?
Well, this week we got an email from Casey Collins, and he asked a question that spurred me to basically outline an entire episode. And his email reads, "I'd be interested in hearing an episode on how and when to make the leap from the day job to working for your business full-time. I'm working a standard full-time job and just starting to build my SaaS app. What goals or milestones should I set to gauge whether or not I'm ready to make that leap?" So we've prepared 7 milestones that I think you should target along this path. And it may not be the same in every case, but this is a nice general framework to kind of get you going. And under each milestone, we have some action items you should take to kind of make sure that milestone is accomplished or to help you get to that milestone. So to kick us off, the first milestone is preparation. It's really a pre-milestone. And there's a couple things here that I think are key if you are going to embark upon this journey and try to get from salaried gig to making a living from product or even a productized consulting service. And the first thing I think you want to keep in mind is that having a runway of some kind, some type of cash runway, is amazing. If you can get 3 months of living expenses, awesome. If you can get 6 months, even better. Because even once you make the leap and you have an app that's covering a good chunk of your income, it is so nice to have that comfort and the lack of stress by knowing that there's a chunk of cash in the bank that you can turn to if you need to in like a dire situation or in case anything goes wrong as you make this jump to living off your product.
I think something that kind of goes along tightly with that is making sure that you don't have a lot of debt when you're trying to start a business. Debt itself can be crushing, especially if you are floating a lot of money on credit cards or different debts that you've accumulated, whether it's student loans or mortgage or car payments, or even just things where you have refinanced something or you have financing on something for like your house, whether it's like roof or siding or anything like that. Any of those debts, they basically weigh you down and they can make it much more difficult and much more stressful to start a business because you have all this interest and extra debt that you're paying on a monthly basis. And yes, it's in some cases it's very valid, but it also hurts a lot because you have to pay attention to that and there's mental overhead associated with all that stuff. So it's not just about reducing the cost of your day-to-day living expenses. It's about reducing the outgoing cash flow on a monthly basis as well. Not just the outbound cash itself, but the interest associated with it too.
If I were in the position where I had $10,000 or $20,000 of credit card debt, and I was considering going and trying to start a product business, I would not start a product business. And instead, I would take my evening and weekend hours and I would do freelance work. And I would pay that debt off in full before I did it. That's my style. I think that's probably the best advice in most situations. But as you said, it's just this anchor that like sucks the cash out of you. And it's really going to be that much harder to start to make a full-time living off a product. It's not hard enough without having that as well. I think the second piece of this preparation milestone is to get buy-in from the key people in your life. That's most likely a significant other, whether it's a girlfriend, spouse, husband, kids are old enough, maybe it's them. Maybe if you still live with your parents, it's them. But it's someone around you who is going to be impacted by this. I think that's the biggest deal, right? Is, are they going to be impacted by taking this leap? And so if you share finances with someone else, that's someone who kind of needs to do the buy-in. And I think, you know, a husband or wife is a perfect example of this. Without getting their buy-in, A, you're not really treating them with respect. Like, you're going to be making financial decisions that could negatively impact the partnership and could negatively impact both of you. And that person deserves a say before you do that. And then the other thing is it can cause a real rift. I mean, businesses can cause divorce and they can cause people to split up. And that's obviously not something you want to do. So I think having that conversation really before you start building this app and going on this, what amounts to a pretty tough journey, is a good step to take.
I think sometimes it's difficult to explain exactly why it is that you want to do this, because building your own business is a heck of a lot harder and more involved than just going out and getting a full-time job. And you get the income from that full-time job or the consulting revenue fairly quickly. So trying to relay that information about, oh, this is why I want to do this. And if you're looking down the road at long-term fulfillment or the monetary rewards down the road, it's not always clear cut to most people. I find that my brain tends to be wired a lot differently in terms of how I look at things like that than other people I know who are not entrepreneurs or are not doing their own thing. And they have a 9-to-5 job, they go to it and they come home and they don't really see how, oh, why is it that you're working on this thing that you're not seeing any benefits from it right now? And it can be very difficult to explain that kind of stuff. So you really do need to be on the same page, not just in why you want to do it, but what are the long-term benefits of it, assuming that you are successful. And that also goes along with making sure that you're relaying information about how things are going to your significant other, because they need to know how things are going because they are invested in the relationship, maybe not necessarily in the business. They want you to be successful, but as a byproduct, like, it does affect your relationship and it really can hurt it over time.
Yeah, I agree. And I also think that I would consider giving someone who had a lot of questions about this and really wanted to dig into it, give them the book, The End of Jobs. Taylor Pearson came on the podcast a while back, but it helps explain why entrepreneurship is actually a logical choice, you know, and can be as good as or better than salaried employment, especially moving forward. And it makes a kind of a logical argument around that. Last step for preparation is to put together a spreadsheet with estimates of how long it's going to take to build what you need. And at this point, it's going to be more of a guess because I'm assuming you're just starting conversations with customers or future customers at this point. So you may not know exactly what you want, but a problem I see with some folks who are building products, actually many of them, is that they don't have any concept of how long it's going to take them to build what they are building. And they just sit down to build the next page in the website, really without a spec telling them what the overall scope of things is, and no concept of when they'll be done. And when I say spec, I don't mean that you write some type of full functional spec like you would if you were a consulting firm. I mean a few lines in an Excel spreadsheet or a Google Doc that basically says, here are the high level, whether you want to do it from database up or top down from the UI elements. I typically go from UI stuff, and you say how much each page is going to take you. And then you add some leeway time, and you add some database architecture time and some deployment time, and you can get a reasonable estimate, even if you're not that great at estimating. If you're within 30, 40%, that will help you know, is this a two-year development project you're tackling, or is this a three-month development project you're tackling? And knowing that from the start is huge. And I think without doing that, I feel like you're flying blind and you have no concept of what it is you're building and how long it's going to take. And my other kind of final hack for this is there's this cool function in Excel and in Google spreadsheets called Workday. And if you put all the numbers in and figure out how many hours it is, you can put Workday in and you can figure out what date that you're going to complete this project. And it will give you the date as of today if you work a certain amount of hours per week. And then if you don't work in a week, that date pushes out. And so this is a very tangible and real way to watch your date slip, really without any work required on your part. But every time you log into this thing, you're going to see, oh man, I'm not going to launch until February of next year. I really need to get on this thing. So I think this is a key component to preparation, is to have a concept of the scope of what you're building. Even if that changes, you'll be within a month or two of it. And when you're working part-time like this, nights and weekends, having this is, I think, a big kind of sanity checker to be able to have an idea of how long you're going to be working on this on the side.
Yeah, I think that's a great suggestion. I didn't know about the Workday function. I use Fogbugs and Teamwork and a couple of other tools. But the interesting thing about that is that it's almost like if you're using a GPS and it tells you that you're going to arrive at 5:10 p.m. or something like that, and you hit traffic and suddenly it's taking you longer, and it continually pushes out. And at the end of the day, of course, you know, when you're 30 seconds away, of course, it's going to be extremely accurate. But the further you are out, it is less accurate. And that helps to give you an idea of how far you realistically are from it, because the further you are away from something, the more difficult it is to estimate it. And I find that when you have a lot of tasks that you're not necessarily as familiar with doing because you don't do them on a regular basis, you can be wildly inaccurate by as much as 10x of how close you are with your initial estimate. And then even the things that you are familiar with, those things are very often inaccurate as well. I mean, I've seen developers who are like, oh, this will only take a couple of hours, and inevitably it takes 2 or 3 days. I think I saw something recently where it basically said, take any estimate that you have and add an order of magnitude in order to make it accurate. And I wouldn't say that that's necessarily far-fetched in many cases.
So that was our first milestone, preparation. Milestone number two is to have one person commit to paying you for your product. And this is standard customer development, right? It's getting that commitment and trying to validate the idea up front. So notice, no one's written any code yet, right? Don't go off and build your product. In fact, Casey had said, I've just started building my SaaS app. Well, Casey, I would advise you to stop building your SaaS app and go do this instead. You know, actually get, and I say one person committing to pay you, that's the first milestone. And really the next one, we'll kind of combine it with this, is to get 10 people to commit to paying you. Name a price, get 10 people to commit. And this is going to happen through in-person conversations, either in person via Skype or via email, but it's going to be one-on-one conversations. You can't do this with split testing and sending bulk email and using surveys. Right now is the time to dig in and really get 10 people. And don't write a line of code until you have those 10 people. That's what we did with Drip. I refused to get started on it until we had some commitments and I knew that we had enough interest that it was worth digging in and starting to write code.
I think this step is really hard for a lot of people because they don't have anything that they can really show to people, yet you're kind of asking for people to make commitments to pay you for something that just simply doesn't exist. And the term that comes to mind is vaporware. You're just like, oh, you're selling something that just doesn't exist. And in some cases, the advice is, oh, you should definitely take somebody's money. And there's a counter advice which says that you shouldn't, at the very least, get the commitment. But those two things are just kind of a natural progression. I mean, if you get somebody to commit to paying you money, that's only one more step to get them to actually give you the money. And if you don't deliver, if you don't follow through, then give the money back. It's not that big a deal. I was talking to a couple of entrepreneurs who deal in the real estate space, and they were having a hard time doing this. And I kind of put it in perspective for them, because I was like, well, how much are they paying for some of their leads, and how much are they making from some of the different things that they're doing? And of course, it's thousands and thousands of dollars, because it's a percentage of the real estate transaction. And I was like, you're asking them for a commitment of $100 to $200, which is not a big deal. And later on, a few weeks later, we talked, and they're like, oh, yeah, I went out and I did that, and I got three people to give me $100. And they're like, oh, yeah, it was no big deal at all. The other person just didn't even blink. They're like, oh, $100? Sure, no problem, whatever. Because in the grand scheme of things to that business, that $100 does not make a difference. But to an individual, it might. So it does depend a little bit on the type of business that you're talking to. But getting that commitment means a lot, and it helps you really determine whether or not it's something that people are willing to pay for. So whether you ask for the credit card or you just ask them for that commitment, each of those things are a step that takes you a little bit further, and it really just depends on how far you want to go.
I agree with you that this is hard for most people, and most people don't do it, actually. And this was very hard for me when we were getting Drip started, because we wanted to build the thing, because we just knew that everybody was going to throw money at us when it was done. And these conversations are hard, and they're uncomfortable, because you have an idea of what you want, and you feel like when people tell you no, that they don't quite understand what you're really saying. You know, they don't really get what you want to build. But this is when the iron meets iron and the sparks fly, and you have to figure out if your vision for your product is correct, or if you need to make adjustments, or if you're just not describing it well enough. And this is where I didn't have anything to show. We had no screenshots. And if I were to do it again, I would probably try to produce a screenshot or two or a flow diagram or something to demonstrate it. But all I had was a list of bullet points. And it was just the value proposition, right? You don't need to walk through and say, these are all the screens that are going to be in there. And then you're going to click this button and then that. That's not the point. The point is, would you pay for something that does this, that gives you this end result? That's what you're selling here. You're really selling a solution to a problem rather than an actual piece of software at this point. And you're just finding out, is this enough of a problem that you would pay X dollars to have it solved? And if you can get commitments for that, then you have to solve the problem. And maybe the software you have in mind right now solves that problem, and maybe it doesn't, but at least it's a start. And if you launch that version 0.5 and it doesn't quite solve it, then you iterate on it until it does solve that problem. But if you validated that this problem has a need and people are willing to pay $100 a month for this thing, that's a really good start. That's a 10 times better start than most founders I know have these days when they start writing code. And the second piece of this second milestone, which is basically to get one or 10 people to commit to paying you, is to start building your launch list. I mean, it's what to do right after you do get those commitments, or as you're going about getting those commitments. And so the traditional advice that I would give is to get a landing page up and start collecting emails from day minus one, right, before you start writing any code. But you and I had a discussion offline, and it doesn't have to be an email address that you ask for. It's going to depend on your market. If your audience is online, then yes, an email address and a first name is fantastic, super helpful. But maybe you could ask for phone number instead if you feel like that's going to be a quicker or an easier way to get in touch with people. Or maybe you can just have a button right there that says, hey, if you want to hear about it when it launches, if you're all in, you know, give us your email. Otherwise, click this button right here, and this will call me on Skype. There's like click-to-call services all over the place, where they can click and they can either have a phone conversation with you right now, or they can schedule one. And, you know, I can imagine some developers listening to this might think, ew, I don't want to be talking to people, right? You just want to go in a basement and write code. And I'm not saying you're going to have to talk to people every time you sell every copy of your product. But at this point, this early in the game, if you're trying to build something that people want, you have to get into conversations with people in order to figure out if what you're building is going to solve their problem.
I think that's probably the most painful part of this is because we're so used to writing code that like that's all we want to do. And it does make sense because that's kind of your comfort zone. It's what you're familiar with. And you're trying to talk to people about something that is very nebulous. It's an unknown. And you're trying to get to the heart of, okay, well, what is it that you would actually pay for, as opposed to solving a problem that somebody came to you and said, I have this problem, solve it for me. And please write code to solve this. What you're doing is you're kind of going at it from another angle, which you're just not comfortable with, trying to say, well, what problems do you have? And are they painful enough that you will pay me for them or pay for a solution to them? And it's just because of that, I'll say, that awkward angle of approach, it makes it difficult for most people to try and make that mental leap.
The last piece I'll say about this building your launch list is we get this email a lot saying, how do I drive traffic to a pre-launch landing page? And frankly, every way that you would do it after launch, you can do it pre-launch. So there's SEO, there's pay-per-click, there's mentioning it in forums, there's in-person conversations, there's cold emails, and there's all types of stuff. The point is not to get hung up with figuring out this silver bullet that's going to drive this. The point is, at this point, you're really trying to validate the idea, make sure some people will pay you for it, and trying to build as large of an interest list as you can. Milestone number three is to get that first paying customer. And this is that point. You're still pre-launch, right? But let's say you're approaching launch. I think this is when you probably have a beta version that does something. And it does something well enough that some person says, hey, I'm really willing to kind of take a leap on you. And you give them that credit card form. Maybe you've let them use the app. You've let them try it out, get some value out of it. And then you ask them the big question and you say, are you getting enough value out of this to pay X dollars for this app, whether it's one time or monthly? And this is a big milestone. It's milestone number three, which is basically to get some amount of money in your bank account from someone who is willing to buy your app.
And you'll notice that this kind of comes before the full launch for the product, because I think the last thing you probably want to do is to launch your app and have a ton of people using it and only to find out that there's major problems with it, or there are things that you hadn't considered in solving the problem that other people are having. So I'm kind of a big fan of like the slow launch, where you take the product, you put it out there to like one or two people and get that feedback from them that you need in order to help make it better, but to also help flush out the bugs, because you're not going to have a perfect product from day one, and you want to start getting that feedback so you can have conversations around some of the deficiencies of the product, because there will be deficiencies. It's not going to be perfect out the door. The other thing that does as kind of a side effect is that when somebody comes to you and says, hey, you know, I like this and all, but it'd be great if it did this. If you've already had those conversations, you kind of have a ready answer for those types of objections. And you can use that to help push people in one direction or the other. Either that's to say, no, we're not going to do that because it just doesn't make sense. It's not in the roadmap. Or you can kind of twist that and say, well, yes, it is. That's something we're going to do. And we're putting it in next week. Can I call you then? Or can we talk about it and revisit this conversation at that point? It puts you in a position such that you can have those conversations. You can have intelligent answers immediately at your tongue, so you don't have to sit around and agonize over what should I do here, because you've already had the conversations. You know what the answer is.
Milestone number four is to actually launch. And obviously, we can and have devoted entire podcast episodes to launching, so I don't think we should belabor this point. But what I do want to call out is that launching is maybe your halfway point. It might even be your third of the way point, because you barely have any revenue at this point. You kind of know that you might solve a problem for a small group of people. I mean, you're really, really early in the game. So don't feel like the launch is the finish line. The launch is when you email your whole list and you try to convert as many as possible. You should have a really good launch day in terms of how many people you convert, because this is your biggest interest list. Make sure not to comp the app to everyone on your interest list. That's like the catastrophic mistake I've seen folks make. You have 500 people on your list. It's the most interested people you've gathered over the past 6 months while you're building it. And then you just give it away free to everybody on the launch list just to try to get them to use it. And that's not a good way to go if you actually want to make some revenue and get to the point where you can quit your job. So this is milestone number four. It's essentially getting to launch, getting through it, and getting some paying customers. And milestone number five is getting that first paying customer post-launch from a cold lead. So this is really starting your marketing after you've gone through your email list, or I should really say continuing your marketing, because you should have already started it when you were building your launch list, but it's continuing to do those things and getting that first paying customer who signs up after launch. And so this is really getting that first paying customer after you launch, and now you're building up towards that point of your quit my job income. And I really should have added one more point to the preparation milestone. Something you should have done before this is to figure out what is that number that you need to quit your job. It's not your salary replacement, right? You might make $15,000 a month in your salary, but if you can cut your expenses and live on $7,000 or $8,000 a month, then that's what you're looking to do. So that should have been up in step one, is figure out your number. Figure out the number that you need to hit. And so right now we're at milestone number five, and you have your first paying customer from your cold lead after your launch, and you should be working your way towards that quit your job number that you figured out.
And I think part of the process that you go through after getting this first customer is to identify ways to make acquiring that customer or that type of customer repeatable. And it's really difficult, I think, mainly because there's such a small sample set here that you've only got one. What is it going to take to get another? Or should you go off in a different direction? And I think that in most cases, you really want to try and figure out, can I repeat this? And if not, are there adjacent areas where I would be able to easily get more customers? So it's about trying to expand from that one customer that you have into other people who are also cold leads. How do you go about nurturing them? Can you set up email campaigns? How do you drive traffic? Should you work on paid advertising? And these are all questions that you kind of have to answer and figure out which channels are going to work for you and which ones aren't. And that's not always easy to do, but there are definitely great resources out there, like the Traction book from Gabriel Weinberg and Justin Maris, that talks about all the different marketing channels you can try and how to go into those and start testing them to see what will work for you and what will not, and what are the kind of the low-hanging fruit for your type of business based on where your business is today.
This is what I like to call the scratching and clawing phase, because you're basically doing anything, even stuff that isn't repeatable, to try to get to your number. And as you said, you might be doing things that aren't repeatable, but you're trying to figure out how to make them repeatable. And the ones that work so-so, you kind of need to leave behind. And the ones that work the best, even if they are very time-consuming or require a lot of manual effort, you still need to do them. This is where you're doing things that are not going to scale at all, because they don't need to scale. They just need to get you to that $7,000, $8,000, $10,000 a month mark where you can quit your job. The last two milestones are really very similar. I put milestone six as hitting an arbitrary 50% of your income. And this is having a net profit after expenses of 50% of your income number that you need to quit your job. And frankly, it's just a milestone to celebrate more than anything. I don't think there's any action items to take here other than to high five yourself and maybe have a nice sip of scotch on your way to reaching this full income. This might take a few months, this might take a year. It depends on so many factors, but it's when your head's down and you're hustling, I find that having these milestones that you can celebrate with your mastermind group or with your significant other become a really big deal on your way to milestone seven, which is hitting that full income number that you need to quit your job. And as I said before, don't try to replace your salary. Just figure out how much it is you need to live and focus on that. The other thing I would look at is just decimating your expenses. So Mike, you talked earlier about getting rid of debt. I know a friend who like sold a rental house that he had owned for a long time, and I think it was like upside down, so the rent wasn't paying the mortgage, and he went through this whole process of selling that before he tried to do this. I sold thousands of dollars worth of stuff on eBay and Craigslist as I was trying to make this transition. I mean, talk about scratching and clawing and doing things that weren't gonna work long-term. This is when you really have to kind of go to the mattresses and figure out, what is it that I need to do that's not irresponsible in order to kind of push me past this point to where I feel comfortable that I can leave my gig for the product income I have, because it's never going to feel fantastic, right? It's never going to be like, oh my goodness, I have so much income and I have so much free time and I'm just going to leave when I want to. You're not going to have enough time before you have enough income. if that makes sense. I mean, you're going to be working 40 hours during the week for your day job and then 30 hours a week at night way before you have enough income to actually leave the job. And so you really have to kind of maximize this thing if you want to leave the job as early as you can.
And this is one of those situations where it's unclear early on, but as your income from the side project becomes much closer to your full-time income, this is where that runway becomes super important. Because if you have that runway and you're able to reach, let's say, the 50% of your income, well, suddenly if you had 6 months of runway before you started this process, once you reach that 50% of your income mark, you now have 12 months of runway, not just six, because you essentially have all this money in the bank, and the money that you have coming in on a monthly basis essentially extends that runway for you. And as your monthly income goes up, your runway gets longer and longer. Well, obviously there's subtleties in there where the business starts to tank or things aren't going so well, your runway can decrease as opposed to increasing. But it's helpful to have that. It really helps from a peace of mind standpoint and being able to, as Rob just said, decimate your expenses and get all of those things off the table. They help to avoid eating away your runway and getting rid of those expenses that you just simply don't need.
Last thing I'll add about reaching this seventh milestone of kind of your full income that you need is to think about how stable that income is. Is it going to fluctuate? Because obviously if it is a bunch of one-time sales and you know that you started zero at the start of the next month, then maybe you need more margin. Maybe you need more runway. But if you have something that's pretty consistent, even if it's not a subscription, but let's say it's a WordPress plugin or it's a website that has nice solid organic SEO and it's pretty consistent month after month, then I think that you have a little more reason to be confident in that. And obviously, if you have true subscriptions like SaaS apps or membership website or something like that, then maybe you need a little less margin and can leave right as you approach that number. And I don't necessarily know that you need to hit that number if you can see your growth numbers going up and you have a trajectory that you know within a month or two, you're going to hit it all together. I stopped doing consulting when my product income hit somewhere around 70 to 80% of my number. And remember, my number was way less than what I was making consulting. But when I got to about 70% of that number that I knew that I needed to make the rent and take care of the family and such, I knew I was probably make it work for the next 3 or 4 months and kind of grow the revenue to get there, because I was pretty desperate to get away from working for other people.
Yeah, and all of this is about risk tolerance at the end of the day. I mean, that income stability and being able to cut your expenses, it's a way to help mitigate the risks of going off and doing your own thing and not being reliant upon an employer for W-2 form or 40 hours a week or what have you. You want to be able to be in control of your own destiny, and sometimes that means taking a little bit of risk. That doesn't necessarily mean that you should put it all on the line and take an extended amount of risk, but there are certain cases where it does make sense to do that, and it's all about risk mitigation. I've talked to people before where they think, oh, you know, you're an entrepreneur, I could never do that, it's too risky. And the reality is that almost every entrepreneur I've ever talked to, most of them don't like taking huge risks. They like to figure out what the risks are and do whatever they can to minimize or mitigate them or make sure that it's not going to be a problem. It's not about having high risk tolerance. It's about making sure that the risks that are there that you are aware of, you try and do as much as you can to get rid of those risks. And the reality is, like, that's what this entire outline is about. It's about how can I minimize the risks of going out on my own.
I'm glad you brought that up. I'm actually listening to an audiobook right now called The Self-Made Billionaire Effect. And it's a small group who researched and studied a bunch of self-made billionaires. They had a list of 600 and then they randomly narrowed down to 120. They've tried to do a scientific study of them and their predispositions and distill some of the characteristics and the behaviors. And one of the things they said is that they did tend to have lower risk tolerances. They were not these crazy risk takers like the world mythologizes and the press talks about. So not that we're trying to build billion-dollar businesses here, but I do think that the sentiment is shared, you know, that most of these successful founders I know are pretty methodical and consistent, and they don't tend to just jump around and take these massive risks like I think people think they do.
Well, that wraps us up for today. If you have a question for us, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it to us at questions@startupsarrestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. You can subscribe to us on iTunes by searching for Startups and visit startupsarrestofus.com for a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.